Well, let me open with a word of prayer today. Dear Lord, our Heavenly Father, you are heavenly. You created all things, and as the author of all things, you have authority over all things. And you created all things by the sheer word of your power. And we know that your works speak every day, that as you sustain all things in an orderly structure, we see your power, your wisdom, your goodness, that you have reason. And we rejoice that you gave us reason, the ability to think and reflect and to understand ideas, to be able to understand ideas that you have shared from your mind to our mind. I pray that you'd give us spiritual understanding this day as we ponder Cicero, this great Roman lawyer and statesman and philosopher, though a pagan, understood much from your general revelation in your works of creation. May we gain wisdom for our republic and our day from Cicero, as the American founders did when they founded this republic. Rebuild our ruins and restore our race for your glory and our good. In Christ's precious name we pray. Amen. Well, today we I'm going to look at Cicero. This is part one, titled It's Cicero and the Law of Nature. So, Lord willing, this class and the next class will look at Cicero. With the death of Cicero in 43 BC, the Roman Republic died. So we're right at the end of the Roman Republic. You remember, we've covered that the founding of Rome, according to legend, was with Romulus in 753 BC, and it had monarchs for 250 years. Kings ruled Rome. And in 509 BC, they replaced the monarch, who had been wicked, with two consuls. But everything else remained the same. Essentially, they then formed the republic overnight. The Senate, Senex stands for old men, so it was the wealthy, wise patricians. You remember their society had patricians and plebes, and the patricians were the property owners, the wealthy. And of the Senate, of Senex, they were the old wealthy, the men, the patriarchs of the wealthy families, the landowning families, the wise men who managed large estates. They had checks and balances during the monarch period. You remember the monarch could choose a successor, and if he didn't, then the Senate could, but had to be approved by the assembly of patricians, the younger wealthy men. They had their own assembly. The king could propose a law. The assembly of patricians of the younger wealthy men could propose a law, but had to be approved by the Senate. The kings had the imperial power. They were the commanders in chief. They headed the church, religion in their society. They were pagans. They had union of church and state. But when they removed the king, they gave the imperial power to two elected consuls, one and two executives, to try and prevent corruption, which they had found in that wicked king. In removing him, said, let's not have the chief executive be one, but have two. But everything else remained the same, with the checks and balances, the separation of powers. The republic, we looked where the plebes demanded more representation. In 494 BC is when they demanded more representation. So then they were granted an assembly in 471 BC. So the poor working farmer plebes were able to get an assembly to represent themselves after the republic was formed. In addition, you had the patrician assembly. In addition, you had the Senate. In addition, you had the two consuls. But everybody had their different functions, separation of powers, checks and balances between them. And then you remember in 451 BC, the plebes wanted written laws. So they demanded 10 representatives be elected to write laws. Several of them visited Athens and came back with Solon's. You remember Solon's reforms, the beginning of Athens. In the early 6th century BC, he brought great reform to Athens and their republic to help balance all the interests in society, from the wealthy and the poor. And the American founders, as we said, studied Solon, because they were at the beginning of the American Republic. He was at the beginning of the Athenian Republic. But that's how Rome was grasping for wisdom from Athens. The representatives came back with laws that Solon had written, copies of those, and then they drafted the 12 tables. So they had a public written law, so everyone knew what their rights were, that covered all sorts of different things, from procedures in courts to marriage, divorce, inheritance, lots of different things were covered in those 12 tables. We've covered how you either went to war to survive, or you became slaves. Those who were defeated in war were raped, pillaged, and plundered. Most women were raped. Most young boys were raped. Sometimes old men were executed if you lost the war at that time. So it was either you become militarily strong, so strong no one wants to fight you, and if you do fight, you're guaranteed you're going to win. So peace through strength was there. Policy. As we said, there was one period of 100 years where basically they fought a war every year in the Roman Republic. When we get to the end, as we will stress, their fateful decision was after the Third Punic War in 146 BC. Punic Wars were against Carthage. Carthage was in northwest Africa, south side of the Mediterranean. And they fought three wars against Carthage. And the third time was like, we've had enough. And that's where they salted the ground of Carthage so that it would never rise again after they defeated them in 146 BC. But their fateful decision was expanding beyond Italy and Sicily, where they decided then to go through Gaul and Great Britain, which Julius Caesar conquered, and they went east across Greece, Macedonia, and further east toward Palestine and Asia Minor, that whole area there, and Egypt. All their main enemies were basically defeated, and they chose easy wealth through military plunder rather than just maintaining secure in Italy and Sicily. And one of the big questions is, how do you maintain high moral character in your citizenry and in your statesmen, those who govern your republic? When we went through Athens, remember, the height of their republic in Athens only lasted 50 years in the mid-5th century, 400s BC. But it was short-lived, and the main reason why it was short-lived was because their religion failed to restrain their sinful impulses. Their pagan mythology, their Greek mythology of pagan gods and goddesses, could not restrain their sinful impulses. When they became prosperous, lots of wealth, and then greed took over and they wanted more easy wealth, and they kept the Delian League going, and we went through all of that, which kept bringing in easy money to Athens. You remember, one of the main theses is that a republic depends upon a moral people. A successful republic, a long-lasting republic, depends upon a moral and religious people. Self-governed, self-controlled people. A republic is when we govern ourselves. Under a monarch, under a king, you're a subject and all you do is do what you're told. But in a republic, we elect our own representatives, we govern ourselves. And you want to be able to not worry about your home getting broken into when you leave your house, or not walking your dog, that you're not going to get robbed and raped. This is a republic. You can get security by a police state, but we don't want that. We like freedom, and liberty and freedom are at the heart of a republic. You remember when Athens was falling, you had Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle as the three main philosophers that sought to restore order to to Athens. And we're going to ponder a little bit of them as well, because Cicero looked to them for wisdom, and particularly Plato. And one of the things to keep in the back of your mind, in Christianity, we make a distinction between general revelation and special revelation. General revelation is God's revelation of His existence and His character in general terms to a general audience. It's through His works of creation and providence. General revelation. And it's to all people, a general audience, but you're not going to learn about the Trinity, you're not going to learn about Jesus Christ studying the rocks and the trees and the stars and the planets. But you will learn certain truths about God, the Creator, by studying God's general revelation. And the Apostle Paul wrote about that. We've covered that in Romans chapter 1, verse 20. That since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes, His eternal power and Godhead are clearly seen, being understood from the things that are made, so that men are without excuse. That we can understand certain attributes and characteristics of God and His existence by studying the things that are made, so that everyone's without excuse if they do not honor Him and give thanks as Creator of all things. Cicero was a pagan. Okay? He was a pagan. He was an idolater. He didn't worship Yahweh, the true and living God. You and I have to remember, he didn't have the Bible. He didn't have the Old Testament scriptures. All he had was general revelation. And all the Greek philosophers had before him were general revelation. He studied them thoroughly. And we'll look at some of that as well. But in my mind, Cicero is the person who came closest to a full, true understanding of a biblical worldview from general revelation. Except in one area, who is God? And we'll talk about his worldview. We'll introduce it at the end of class today. And then finish it next class. You remember the Apostle Paul in Athens, in Acts chapter 17, part of his sermon is recorded for us. He spoke at the Areopagus, Mars Hill in Athens. He preached. He quoted Greek poets, and he quoted Greek philosopher in the midst of his sermon. Just because one's a pagan does not mean everything they say is false. We can gain some wisdom and truth. They can say true things. But certainly, as a pagan, they'll be wrong on some things. And above all, who God is. In 1776 AD, the American founders, as you know, declared political independence from Great Britain. And they fought a war for continued self-government. Their well-established rights as Englishmen were being repeatedly abused by both King and Parliament. In fact, most of the rights listed in the U.S. Bill of Rights, ratified in 1791 A.D., can be traced back through England's constitutional history. Practically all of the rights listed in the U.S. Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution, can be traced back through Great Britain, England's constitutional history. And it was their war for political independence to preserve those legal rights. And the American founders pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to preserve those legal rights. The American founders rejected a legal revolution, like the French Revolution. That was occurring in the 1790s A.D. The American founders rejected a legal revolution. They were appealing to the permanent and unchanging laws of nature and nature's God in their fight to separate their political bonds from Great Britain. Many of you remember the preamble to the U.S. Declaration of Independence in 1776, where they wrote, when in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the equal and separate station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind require that they declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They appealed to the laws of nature and nature's God. They believed in the existence of objective law, both in the physical realm and in the spiritual realm, the moral realm. And in their fight for political independence, to preserve the rule of law, the writings of Cicero, who was a Roman lawyer, a Roman statesman, and a philosopher at the end of the Roman Republic, Cicero lived 106 BC to 43 BC. The writings of Cicero provided the American founders much intellectual wisdom. Great Britain was behaving lawlessly. The ruling elite at the end of the Roman Republic during Cicero's lifetime were behaving lawlessly. And at that time, Cicero appealed to natural law. Law and order. It's tied to the nature of things, reality, objective, outside of our little minds. And the American founders did as well, who were predominantly Christian. Russell Kirk, political scientist in the 20th century, wrote this, quote, "Cicero was the spokesman of the idea of ordered liberty, for which the Americans were seeking. His writings were woven into the schooling Americans had received. The study of Cicero lay at the heart of the curriculum, both in Britain and in America, all during the 17th and 18th centuries, all during the 1600s and 1700s AD. Cicero is at the core of education. The rhetoric they had learned was Ciceronian, and the spaciousness of their own political oratory was modeled upon Cicero," unquote. Leading up to 1776 AD, the American founders endured what they wrote in the Declaration of Independence, a long train of abuses, where Great Britain repeatedly violated legal precedents. It was a period of lawlessness, Great Britain's disregard for law, resembling the late Roman Republic, which tottered on the edge of collapse during the life of Cicero. The Roman Republic, formed in 509 BC, was, by the first century BC, enduring one lawless event after another. And at the end of last class, we covered a little bit of this, but just a reminder. There was the social war from 90 to 88 BC, and then they went through the seven-year civil war, and then the servile war from 73 to 71 BC, led by Spartacus, and then eventually went into the rule of military men, the first triumvirate, Pompey the Great, who had reconquered Asia, Julius Caesar, who had conquered Gaul, meaning France, as well as Great Britain, and military general Crassus, who put down the revolt of the slaves that had been led by Spartacus. And eventually then those three military men reached an alliance to govern the Republic. Cicero lived through all these tumultuous events. Cicero had seen and experienced lawfare, where you take your political opponents to court. He experienced gang violence, terrorist acts, assassinations of political rivals. He himself will die from an assassination, or his head and his hands will be taken on public display. He experienced personal exile from Rome at one point, a four-year exile. He saw corruption among the consuls, the two chief executives of the Republic, as well as corruption among the aristocrats and military generals. In 63 BC, Cicero had made his own way to the top in Roman politics. Cicero served 1 year as consul. Now, that's the equivalent of the U.S. president in our republic. Remember, in 509 BC, they removed the monarch, the king, and replaced that monarch, the chief executive, who was the commander-in-chief, and the one who was the head of their religion and negotiated treaties and all of that, replaced the king with two consuls. And they served one-year terms, elected from the Senate. So they were aristocrats. And really, as I've said, during the monarch period, the 250-year period, it was an aristocratic monarch because the Senate was heavily involved. It was an aristocratic monarchy during that 250-year period at the beginning of Rome, from 753 to 509. It was an aristocratic monarchy. It had checks and balances, and the Senate was at the core of it. And then 509, they removed the king and replaced the king with two consuls who served one-year terms elected from the Senate. So they were aristocrats. That's where the Senate is at the core of the republic. It was an aristocratic republic. Remember, we've said Athens was a democratic republic where their general assembly of all men who were citizens were at the core of their republic in Athens. And one of my arguments is that democratic republics don't last long. They're typically not governed by the best and the elite, the wise. We'll see. Cicero himself argues in his one writing, The Republic, that one of the weaknesses of a democracy is not giving credit and responsibility to the wise and to the more knowledgeable and the more skilled. Remember, they did more and more by lottery. Everybody's equal in a democracy, so let's just choose by lot. Let's throw the dice and it's okay. Fred's just as good as Jim. Well, it's not always the case, right? You and I know people are very different in knowledge, skill, and abilities. God has made us differently, plus how different people have different work ethics and study different, etc. But in 63 BC, Cicero had made his own way to the very top in Roman politics, one of the consuls. And he served 1 year. He defeated the conspiracy of a person named Catiline against the Republic. And really, it was more of an armed insurrection type of conspiracy against the Republic led by Catiline. And what had happened is Cicero, as one of the consuls, executed many of the co-conspirators. But it was done under the advice and consent of the Senate that he did that. They didn't receive a full trial, for which his political enemies took him to task on later. But I want to give you a little flavor of this whole period, and that's what we'll go through, a little bit of the history. You've got to see the lawlessness and chaos late in the Roman Republic before it fell. As a body, at that time, the Roman lawyers, which Cicero was one of the top lawyers at that time, as a body, the Roman lawyers resisted the military men who aspired to dominate the Republic. They're going through all these different wars, right? So the military men kind of rise up and they're the ones that just let me govern everything. As a body, the lawyers in the Republic resisted the military men from governing. They wanted more the rule of law. And Cicero led that effort against the military men. Cicero argued and fought really for the rule of law in his time. But by 61 BC, Cicero was forced into exile by his political enemies. Though Cicero had, over time, aligned himself more closely with the aristocrats in the Senate, he was eventually recalled back to Rome, primarily through a military general, Pompey the Great, and his influence. And the reason was because Pompey the Great began to suffer under the same enemies as Cicero. The main enemy of Cicero was a man named Claudius at that time. And Claudius began to take odds with Pompey the Great. So the idea of your enemy and his enemy, then all of a sudden all align, right? And we'll align against that person together. And it created an alliance then kind of moved Pompey the Great to bring Cicero in to help him against Claudius. Well, the circumstances of Cicero's return to Rome illustrate the lawlessness at that time in the Roman Republic, so I want to give you a little details of that. Cicero's return to Rome was marked by both lawfare and violence against political enemies. In 57 BC, so he was exiled in 61, so he'll be exiled for 4 years, kicked out of Rome. And he'd been consul, of all things. Well, in 57 BC, a political leader in Rome named Titus Annius Milo worked hard to recall Cicero. Milo was a political leader at that time. On January 23rd, 57 BC, Cicero was expected to win a vote among ruling officials for his return. But Claudius, this enemy of Cicero, hired gladiators to massacre people and prevent the vote, which they did. Through violence and death and terrorism, they prevented a vote for Cicero's return. He was expected to win the vote. So rather than let democracy prevail, let's prevent the vote through violence and terror through gladiators. Milo, in a leadership position, tried available legal remedies, such as lawfully arresting as many gladiators as he could who were involved in the massacre. Claudius's supporters begin to attack Milo's house, waylay him on the streets, as one scholar put it, and try to terrorize him with violence. Milo indicted Claudius on a charge of violence. But Claudius was well-connected politically, getting his family and friends in high places to issue an edict that suspended all public business, caused a government shutdown. So the indictment against him couldn't go to trial. Corruption, violence, lawfare. Though committed to the rule of law as earnestly as Cicero was, Milo decided he had no choice but to raise forces of his own to fight back. The rule of law, obviously, was breaking down. Law and justice was giving way to violence. Amidst this gang violence among the ruling elite was when the military general Pompey the Great threw his weight of reputation behind Cicero, successfully getting him recalled back to Rome in 57 BC, ending Cicero's 4-year exile. Now let me just say as a side note, there's record in history that Milo had once said to Cicero that if I have to, I'll kill Claudius. And what had happened at one point later on is Claudius had been found dead along the road. Milo had been brought up on charges of it. No one could prove it. Cicero went in court to defend Milo. And I have one book just looking at the court cases that Cicero had argued during his life. And it seems under the circumstances, perhaps they had met accidentally, Milo and Claudius, on a road one. And there might have been some confusion between them, but yes, it could very well have been that Milo had killed Claudius eventually and got his justice and his revenge. It was a lawless period of time. But when the military men of Pompey the Great, Crassus, and Julius Caesar reinforced their informal alliance and gained control of Roman politics in 56 BC, at the conference of Lucca. That's 1 year after Cicero was recalled. 57, we're counting down to Christ. 1 year later, you had this informal alliance between the military men. We're going to govern Rome. Well, Cicero's political debt to Pompey in leading his recall effort forced Cicero to distance himself from the Roman Senate, which he had traditionally aligned himself with. And because at that point, then the Roman Senate was at odds with the military men. Because the military men are saying, we're going to govern you, looking at the Senate. We're going to take charge of things. So the military men became at odds with the Roman Senate. Cicero had traditionally aligned himself with the Roman Senate, but he owes Pompey the Great, in a sense, because Pompey the Great led his recall effort and got him back to Rome. The Roman Republic, since its founding in 509 BC, had always been centered on the Roman Senate. It was an aristocratic republic, but in 56 BC, the military men were in charge. So you say, well, what's Cicero going to do at this time? It's at that time in his life, isolated from the lawless and violent political establishment, that Cicero turned to writing. From 55 to 51 BC, Cicero undertook an ambitious program of writing his famous works titled On the Orator, the Republic, and the Laws. Essentially, at that time, he was my age. He was in his lower 50s. I'm 54. And that's when he wrote his most famous writings, On the Orator, the Republic, and the Laws. And I had read portions of them in the past. And this last month, I read the Republic in full, and I read the Laws in full. It is a delight to read, I've got to say. Amazing. I'm trying to include a lot of quotes. When we go through Cicero's worldview that he is arguing on behalf of the Roman Republic to restore order, and what he believes is why it lasted over 400 years, I will give you a lot of quotes from Cicero. I'm trying to let him speak for himself. I think I remember reading Dr. Nichols' biography of J. Gresham Machen. They had the 100-year anniversary of Christianity and liberalism just last year. In there, he came from a family of lawyers, and it is mentioned in there, if I recall, that his father was a very busy lawyer, but when he'd come home at night, he liked reading the classics, especially Cicero. And you can see it when you read it. Beautiful writing, very persuasive, quite a thinker, and really what a lot of wisdom of what our culture needs right now, actually. Cicero represented the culmination of pagan thinking about political theory and the Roman state in particular, the Roman Republic. But it's the culmination of pagan thinking on these issues, the apex really of Greco-Roman thinking, of Greek and Roman thinking about the polis, the political community, the city-state, about a republic, about everything entailing law, justice, liberty, nature, and God. As Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle sought to restore and defend law and order in the ruins of the Republic of Athens, remember, it was at the end of the Great Peloponnesian War, at the end of the 400s, going right into the 300s, where Athens was decimated. They lost against Sparta. Socrates died 399 BC. Plato died 347 BC. Aristotle died 322 BC. They're in the ruins of it all, trying to restore the glory and law and order of Athens after its chaos and fall. Well, Cicero here, he valiantly wrote from 55 to 51, and he had another period of writing in the 40s before his death. But here, especially on his most famous works from 55 to 51 BC, he valiantly wrote to restore ordered liberty, the rule of law, to the Roman Republic. In 54 BC, Cicero wrote a letter to his brother saying, I am writing the political treatises I mentioned, unquote. I am writing the political treatises I mentioned, unquote. What's really interesting is, though Cicero wrote in Latin, in the Latin language, the word political is in Greek. So I am writing the political treatises I mentioned. And he's writing in Latin, but the word for political is in Greek. Why? One scholar states this: it refers not primarily to practical politics, but to a branch of philosophy, the theory of the polis or city-state. This was regarded as part of the larger study of ethics, the theory of human character and behavior. Cicero, in other words, was writing a work in the tradition of Plato and Aristotle, as far as we know, the first of its kind in Latin, which would cover not only the theory of constitutions and laws, but also matters such as the moral education and training of citizens, the place of culture and the arts in a well-run society, the character of the kind of individual best equipped to take part in government, and, perhaps more surprisingly for a modern reader, the place of well-run states in the cosmic order. Now, you remember with Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, we dealt with pre-Socratic philosophers and then Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. The pre-Socratic philosophers were scientists. We're talking about natural philosophy, pondering the physical world. With Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, there they begin with studying the polis, the city-state, which is under the umbrella of ethics. Because for them, what is a republic is the human soul writ large. A well-ordered republic depends upon a well-ordered citizenry in their own souls. So it's under the umbrella of ethics, what's right and wrong, which laws then embody what ought to be and what ought not to be in our social relationships in our city-state. That's what he then, for the first time in Latin, began to write. But ponder that last idea, the place of well-run states in the cosmic order. Cicero's fundamental idea is that this world is a cosmos, not chaos. There is order in all things, including us as humans and in our political associations. In other words, we're not just becoming, involving change, but we are human beings. I may be getting more gray in my beard, maybe getting a little heavier. I'm getting older. I'm changing all the time. So are you. But as we have talked about when we went through the Greek philosophers, there's also the idea of being. Being means what does not change, the essence of something, the nature of something, the substance of something that does not change. That you and I are human beings, and you can't erase that fact. You can't become a dog or a cat. So we're not just becoming, but we are human beings. We have a human nature that does not change, and that essence or being or nature of who we are as humans defines for us what ought to be. We've talked about it in the Christian worldview. Because we are created in the image of God, Genesis 1, 26 and 27, therefore, we ought to be a limited reflection of who God is, because that defines what we are in essence. We're created in the image of God. Let us make man in our image. What is man? Created in the image of God. A limited reflection of who he is. You cannot change that fact. But your nature, your essence in the image of God, then defines what you ought to be. Because he's truthful, you ought to be truthful. Cicero argues this. As we saw, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle argued it in their own ways. And when order, coinciding with nature, is achieved in the human soul, it is reflected in the order of the polis, the city-state. Law that exemplifies justice, what's right, what's fair, embodies the order of nature, both commanding and forbidding certain behavior for human beings. Law that structures and orders our lives in a certain way. It structures and orders our lives in a certain way. I like the videos where they take of traffic at a big city. At the spaghetti intersection of the highways all going in and out, and then they record it for hours, but then they play it fast. And then you see all these cars in motion, right? Every once in a while there might be a car accident. But basically you see all this harmony, and the laws have the structure. There's stopping at stop signs. There's going on green. There's law gives us structure and order in our lives. Law involves commands and prohibitions, proceeding ultimately then from a wise and rational divine lawgiver. If you acknowledge that there's such a thing as law, then what does that imply? That there is a lawgiver, one who gave the law. And if you accept that there are laws in nature, then there must be a lawgiver over nature. Justice coincides with ultimate law, which are commands and prohibitions of God, the chief lawgiver, and they are right and what ought to be because of who God is. Order and harmony in our world demand that we recognize the existence of an intelligent designer. These ideas comprise some of Cicero's thoughts that I've just mentioned. Although Cicero was a pagan, it is not surprising, this is what Russell Kirk states, as a model of republican virtue, Cicero meant much to the leaders of the infant American Republic, unquote. In particular, the American founders studied Cicero's The Republic and the laws. They had them in their hands. They read them. And both were written in Plato's style using dialogues. You remember Plato and how he wrote with conversation between different people, dialogues. And that's the way Cicero writes. And it's just music to your ears to read how he begins a dialogue, and he's got 2-3 intellectual men, and they're going to take a walk through the trees and hear the poplar leaves move and rustle and the ocean's in the distance, and you can picture them on a seaside area by a villa, and they're going to walk along the trail and talk through these issues. In the laws, Cicero mentions that, quote, my whole thesis aims to bring stability to states, steadiness to cities, and well-being to communities, unquote. In the laws, Cicero mentions, quote, my whole thesis aims to bring stability to states, steadiness to cities, and well-being to communities, unquote, which they did not have at that time. And as we know in our time, we've got much that's not stable and steady, and there's not much well-being. There's a lot of chaos, a lot of violence, a lot of lawfare in our states, cities, and communities. Lawless chaos must be extinguished by citizens who embrace God-given law and order that embodies both wisdom and justice, grounded in the reality of the order of nature, the laws of nature and nature's God. That's the opening paragraph of the Declaration of Independence states. Cicero believed in a law of nature and nature's God, a pagan God, but a supreme God that gave law and order to this world so that it would be an orderly system governed by laws that were just and right. As humans, we build on the shoulders of those who have gone before us. As humans, none of us in a real sense are original in our thinking. In other words, every one of us fine-tunes our thinking over time. Our understanding of both ideas and reality is shaped more and more as we ponder what other intelligent people have had to say on things. In his writings, Cicero repeatedly discussed many of the ideas of the Greek philosophers. Repeatedly. And as we have seen, the pre-Socratics argued for order in the physical world in their search for the arche, the stuff of which all things are made. We covered quite a bit of detail on the pre-Socratics. And I wanted to do that to impress upon you how in different ways they had different beliefs, but they all believed basically in the order and structure and rational unity of this physical world. And they were looking for the arche, the stuff of which all things were ultimately made. Some of them said it was fire. Some of them said it was air. Some said water, right? Different things. But they believed in order and structure. They were scientific. They were natural philosophers, the pre-Socratics. And you remember one pre-Socratic philosopher we discussed was named Pythagoras, who died 500 BC. And we had mentioned the Pythagorean theorem, as many of you have experienced in school. Pythagoras died 500 BC. He was one of the pre-Socratics. And he had said that the arche of all things is numbers. He was a mathematician. And remember, his view of numbers is a little different than you and I. He actually believed numbers were physical things. Unique. But they came up with mathematical formulas with music, the harmony that's there. Since there is a mathematical order to nature, one of his contemporaries, Thales of Miletus, who died 546 BC, you remember Thales of Miletus is credited as the father of ancient Greek philosophy. Thales of Miletus died 546 BC. Remember, he accurately predicted a solar eclipse that occurred on May 28th, 585 BC. And you can only accurately predict a solar eclipse if there is regular order and harmony in the universe. Say, it's going to come around again at this particular date and time. And it did. He accurately predicted it, proving that the universe is mathematical and orderly. Socrates, as we said, died 399 BC, Plato 347 BC, and Aristotle 322 BC, all argued that the order of our world not only included the physical realm that the pre-Socratics were dealing with, but also human beings. Political philosophy began with Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, studying the polis under the umbrella of ethics, saying there's order not just in the physical realm, but with human beings and in our social relationships. So they studied the polis, considering man's ethical obligations to act consistent with the order of the universe. Pythagoras was unique as a rational scientific philosopher. He's a pre-Socratic. But he was unique because he also embraced a religion called Orphism. Orphism said that intelligent reason is divine and found within every human being. You and I are able to reason. We're able to think, reflect, come to logical conclusions, argue, propose an idea. He believed, as a part of his religion in Orphism, that intelligent reason is divine and it's found within every human being. Most of the Greek philosophers, in their rational scientific quest to understand the order of the world in which they lived, as we've noted, they rejected the chaotic, mythical gods and goddesses of ancient Greece. And we covered Greek mythology pretty thoroughly because I wanted to impress upon you how disorderly and chaotic it was. There was the idea within ancient Greek mythology that there's just this eternal, chaotic stream of organic matter, like a stream of just chaotic things. Eternal, and the gods and goddesses are in the spiritual realm and they enter the physical realm. They marry and have children and they divorce and they commit adultery and do different things. Some were drunkards, some were homosexual. They had a lot of chaos within their gods and goddesses. Most of the Greek philosophers, though, rejected that. Said, we reject that to explain the world. And they were scientific. They said, this is orderly and we're going to approach it mathematically and orderly and structurally. Well, Pythagoras was an interesting individual because he was both religious and scientific. He embraced this Orphism, that human reason, this intelligent reason within every human being is divine in his mind, Just to stress again, in Greek mythology, the world is chaos. It's not orderly cosmos. In Greek mythology, all you have is diversity, no unity. It's not a system. It's not a universe. It's not a cosmos. All it is chaos. That's what we've said is basically what was revived in the 1960s Cultural Revolution, the neo-paganism, is that all there is chaos. That's what we're fighting against right now. That's what's taken over our elite universities and colleges, is neo-paganism, that everything's just chaos. There's no such thing as human nature, a human being. That's why transgenderism is all over, and homosexuality and lesbianism. There's no such thing as a human being. Anything goes. My wife told me just the other week, she heard in the news some woman in California married a cat. What in the world? That's along the lines, though, of ancient Greek mythology, where anything goes. There's no order and structure. Things aren't in rational categories. Pythagoras was unique, though, because he has this religion of Orphism, but it involves reason, rationality, and he considered it divine, and he was scientific as he's developing the Pythagorean theorem and other mathematical formulas of our world. His goddess was reason, a faculty of the human mind, but in his mind we share it with divinity. Other Greek pre-Socratic philosophers had similar notions, and we've discussed them, though they didn't express them in religious terms. Heraclitus died 475 BC, we've covered him, and he said what was behind the order in our ever-changing world was called the Logos, the Greek word Logos. And he was the first to use that term in such a way as we know. Remember, Heraclitus said, he's usually credited with the quote, "You can never step in the same stream twice." But his actual quote is, "Of those stepping into rivers staying the same, other and other waters flow." Of those stepping into rivers staying the same, other and other waters flow. Amidst all the change, other and other waters flow, rivers remain rivers. Dogs remain dogs. Cats remain cats. Houses remain houses. Your mind knows this. My mind knows this. So there's becoming, other and other waters flow. There's always change. But there is being, of those stepping into rivers staying the same. We know a river when we see it. You know a chair when you see it. It's not a table. Why is that? It's part of the order and the structure of the world. And he said what's behind all of the order and structure, amidst all this change, there's order and structure. And what's behind the order and structure, Heraclitus said, is the Logos. Anaxagoras, another pre-Socratic philosopher of ancient Greece, died 428 BC. We covered him. And he said what's behind the order is called the mind. The mind. For Heraclitus and Anaxagoras, whether they're calling it the Logos or the mind, to them physical matter was eternal, and either the Logos or the mind was an impersonal power or force, just like gravity. An impersonal, non-personal power or force like gravity that causes the order to exist in the world. Where houses remain houses, rivers remain rivers, dogs remain dogs. With Pythagoras, you get a little bit more, maybe it's personal. What's interesting in this is that the city of Rome, as you know, sits on the west side of central Italy. Significantly, Pythagoras, died 500 BC, lived in southern Italy. But think of that. The city of Rome sits on the west side of Italy, of central Italy. Pythagoras lived in southern Italy, and he died 9 years after the Roman Republic was founded in 509 BC. Pythagoras has unique views because he's a pre-Socratic, he's a scientist, he believes the world is mathematical. It's ordered, it's structured, it's mathematical, but he's also religious. He embraced this Orphism, that reason, this faculty of reason found in all human beings, is divine. In other words, it seems that his views had an impact upon people who lived in Italy, particularly in the Roman Republic. In Pythagoras' philosophy, there is the existence then of both a rational, supreme, divine being and rational order in the cosmos. I want you to think about that a minute. Pythagoras died 500 BC, 9 years after the Roman Republic was founded in 509 BC. He's living in southern Italy. Rome, the city of Rome, is in the west of central Italy. But Pythagoras, this philosopher, is both theological and scientific. He's both theological and scientific. He's saying God exists. It's reason found within every human being. And he's scientific. He's mathematical. It's an orderly world. Cicero's argument is that the combination of those two ideas provided the successful ordered liberty of the Roman Republic, enabling it to last over 400 years. Cicero revered Plato. Plato revered Pythagoras. Cicero revered Plato. Plato revered Pythagoras. So how did Pythagoras' understanding of the world end up down through Rome to Cicero? Through Plato. In Cicero's dialogue, in the Laws, Plato is described as, quote, your idol and favorite, whom you revere above all others, unquote. And he goes on, quote, Plato, that most learned man and most weighty of thinkers, unquote. Obviously regarded Plato as the best of the Greek philosophers. In Cicero's dialogue, The Republic, he writes, quote, on Socrates' death, Plato traveled first to Egypt on a study tour and then to Italy and Sicily to gain a thorough mastery of Pythagoras' discoveries, unquote. Socrates died in 399. Socrates, his best student was who? Plato. Who was Plato's best student? Aristotle. And they were the ones arguing for order, trying to restore law and order. So I'll read that again. In Cicero's dialogue, The Republic, he writes, quote, on Socrates' death, 399 BC, remember Plato was Socrates' student. On Socrates' death, Plato traveled first to Egypt on a study tour and then to Italy and Sicily to gain a thorough mastery of Pythagoras' discoveries, unquote. And remember in the school that Plato had set up in Athens, essentially had the plaque that said, let none but mathematicians enter here. What did you have with Pythagoras? The arche of all things is numbers. But he went and he traveled to the school that Pythagoras had set up. Pythagoras died 500 BC, but set up a school. So his ideas were carried on by students of his, that school. And then Plato, once Socrates died in 399, went on a journey, a travel studying in Egypt, and then went on to master the ideas of Pythagoras at the school that he had started in southern Italy. Cicero continues in his writings and says this, quote, as Pythagoras' reputation was high at that time in those centers, Plato devoted himself to his adherents and interests. That's why, as he was fond of Socrates above all others and wished to attribute everything to him, he interwove Socrates' charm and verbal acuteness with the abstruseness, the hard to understand, of Pythagoras and his weighty contributions to so many areas of knowledge. Unquote. That's the words of Cicero. So my argument, and I think it's clear from the writings of Cicero, and you'll see it in his worldview, theology and science. There's a unity and order to all things in the physical realm because of a supreme being that is structured and ordered in all and governs it all. So as a pagan, he believed in many gods. but he believed in one supreme God. Okay? For Pythagoras, it was right reason. Reason. You'll see it a little variant, though, in Cicero, where it's more personal. Okay? Now, once the Roman Republic won the Third Punic War, we've mentioned that, 146 BC, you remember it made the fateful decision to militarily expand its borders beyond Italy and Sicily. So the aristocratic Roman Republic gave in to the temptation of easy wealth by military plunder, by military stealing. Remember we pointed out in last class, that same year, 146 BC, they finally defeat Carthage and they salt the ground in Carthage so it'll never rise again. And they decide to expand beyond Italy and Sicily, even though they don't have to for their security. Everything they'd fought up to that point, everything from the founding of Rome was for security. During the monarchical period, from Romulus, 753 BC to 509 BC, during the monarchs, and then the Republic from 509 BC all the way down to 146. At that point, all of it was for security when they fought military wars. If you lost, as I said, all the women and boys could get raped, all the men could get executed, everybody could be taken as slaves. It was nasty. So you better be prepared to fight, and you better be prepared to win. And they did. Well, once they defeated Carthage, they got addicted to easy wealth by plunder. Remember, once they defeated an area, the military generals took over in distributing the land, and they typically brought in Romans, usually, to be farmers and work the land. Farming was the core of their economy. And Victor Davis Hanson has written with the Greeks as well, with the Roman Republic, that with farming, remember, you're managing your own business, you're deciding when to plant, when to harvest, what to do with the product when you're done. Do you want to turn the grapes into wine or the olives into olive oil, and how you're going to sell it in the marketplace? You make all these decisions yourself. And then when you go to war, you make decisions on the fly, and that's why free people make the best warriors. It's Victor Davis Hanson's argument. It was a key to Rome's success, not just Athens, militarily. But they got addicted to military plunder rather than earning by farming, making your wealth by farming. And they, in 146 BC, the same year they defeated Carthage in the Third Punic War, that year they decided to go east to Greece. They destroyed Corinth, the cultural center of Greece. For no security reason, they plundered it. Because they could, militarily. They stole. So no longer were Roman military campaigns thereafter about maintaining security of the Republic, but military plundering and stealing. And once Greece was defeated east of Italy, as we said last class, many of the sophists traveled to Rome, bringing their relativistic subjectivism with them. We covered the sophists. They were traveling philosophers during the collapse of the Athenian Republic. But they were traveling philosophers in Greece. They didn't believe in objective reality. They said personal perception is reality. So it was pure relativistic subjectivism. What's your perception of reality is truth for you. What my perception of reality is truth for me, even though it may contradict what yours is. For sophists, they were rhetoricians, teaching people how to speak, but words were playthings to them. Especially universal words, like truth, goodness, justice, man, beauty. Just playthings. They didn't represent reality. Everything was relative to the sophists. So sophist ideas then, once Rome went east, defeats Greece, sophists travel to Rome and bring their subjective relativism to Rome, denying objective reality and ethics, and then they further encouraged lawless plunder and selfish, violent living within the Roman Republic. And I've told you, the sophists in our day are the Democrats. Words are mere playthings. You would lose an election, it's purely a matter of messaging. We didn't give the right word. Transgenderism is the way it is. Anything goes. It's your power. Whatever I say to get to power. Cicero, by contrast, believed in the natural law, grounded in the order of the cosmos, established by this supreme rational divine being. Cicero argued that the rule of law in a polis is ultimately grounded in the order of the universe. For Cicero, the high old Roman virtue that gave the Roman Republic long-lasting success was grounded in the worldview which he presents, in the laws especially, but also in the Republic. And it involves five fundamental ideas in his worldview. That was behind the high old Roman virtue that gave it success for over 400 years as a republic. And remember, this is one of the reasons we've said most of the American founders were Christians in 1776, when the Declaration of Independence was written, in 1787, when the Constitution was written. Most of our founders, for both documents, were Christians. Western civilization began in Jerusalem. We're including Athens in our journey through Western civilization because that's where republics began. We formed a republic. And the American founders studied Solon and others from Athens about republics. But they wanted a long-lasting republic. And remember, there was one Greek, Polybius, who had been exiled and taken to Rome in the 2nd century B.C., and he wrote his works, The Histories of Rome. And that also you could buy today. The American founders had it. They knew a lot about the Roman Republic from Polybius's The Histories. And they wanted a long-lasting republic, which is why then they studied more the Roman Republic more than the 50-year-long Athenian Republic. And I believe then they formed more of an aristocratic republic, emulating Rome's republic, rather than a democratic republic, emulating Athens. But that's why Athens is included in our journey through Western civilization. That's where republics began in the history of the world. And we formed a republic in America. And Rome is included because the Roman Republic lasted over 400 years. And the American founders studied Polybius and studied Cicero to understand why the Roman Republic was successful. But you can see when you understand these five fundamental ideas of his worldview, the worldview that made the Roman Republic successful, you can then see, you'll see, I think, why the Roman Republic then is included in Western civilization, why we, as a nation founded by Christians, as a republic founded by Christians, ponder the pagan Roman Republic. These five beliefs, fundamental ideas, we're going to just get into the first two here now, and then, Lord willing, next class, get into 3, 4, and 5. But the five are this. The first is that the world is an orderly cosmos. Cosmos meaning system. It's orderly, it's structured, it's a system. We speak of a solar system. Your body has many systems. Right? The whole world is a system. It's a cosmos, not chaos. But the world is an orderly cosmos governed by a rational divine providence. Secondly, human beings are creatures who exist between the animals and God, sharing divine reason, law, and justice. Human beings are creatures who exist between the animals and God, sharing divine reason, law, and justice. The third fundamental idea, is that a human being is a distinct species. A human being is a distinct species. Fourth, law and justice are based on the objective order of nature, not on man's opinion. Law and justice are based on the objective order of nature, not on man's opinion. And fifth, human moral excellence can only be realized in communities. Human moral excellence can only be realized in communities. You can be moral all by yourself, living like Jeremiah Johnson in the middle of nowhere in the wilderness, because we are by nature social creatures. Moral excellence is only achieved in community. I want you to think about each of these real quick. First, the world is an orderly cosmos, an orderly system governed by rational divine providence. Cicero was a pagan. You have many gods and goddesses. But he believed there was one supreme God that governed all things of the pagan gods. Jerusalem. It began in Jerusalem in Western civilization. In Israel, the world is an orderly cosmos, an orderly system governed by rational divine providence. Psalm 103, verse 19. The Lord has established his throne in the heavens, and his sovereignty rules over all. God, in an orderly fashion, the week of creation, created everything after its kind. The world is an orderly cosmos, an orderly system governed by a rational divine providence. And we would agree with that, we just disagree as to the character of God. Who is God? But you find that also with Jehovah's Witnesses, formed in 1870, the JWs. They say Jesus Christ is a mere man, a created being. They deny the Trinity. Do they believe in creation? Do they believe in God reigns and rules over all things? But we disagree, who is God? Say that with the Mormon, Church of Latter-day Saints. My point is, even within Christianity, where we've had sects that have broken off as heretics, there's much in the worldview that's still this idea that this is an orderly system governed by divine providence. He was a pagan. The Roman Republic, they were pagans, believed in many gods and goddesses. But Cicero is saying Rome's success was believing in a supreme divine being, providence that governs all things. And the thing that he created, this universe, is orderly. It's a system. The second one, human beings are creatures who exist between the animals and God, sharing reason, law, and justice. We're creatures between animals and God. We know it was on the sixth day in Genesis chapter 1 where God created human beings after his image. Genesis 1, 26 and 27. Let us make man after our image, male and female. And as human beings, we share divine reason, law, and justice. 2 Timothy 2:13. If we are faithless, God remains faithful, for he cannot deny himself. He cannot contradict himself. The logical law of non-contradiction flows from who God is. He's rational. He speaks rationally. Christ and Antichrist cannot mean the same thing. Good and evil cannot mean the same thing. He's rational. Something cannot be both what it is and not what it is at the same time or in the same relationship. Reason is the idea that we can convey from one mind to another ideas. That we can differentiate or combine ideas, that we can reflect, come to logical conclusions, following the logical law of non-contradiction, following the law of causation. Just as I'm standing here now, conveying ideas from my mind to your mind, a rational being to another rational being. And God created us to have a relationship with him, rationally. God placed Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. He walked with them there. He talked with them. He reveals, he speaks ideas through prophets and apostles that are written in the Bible. Law. We share law with God. Romans 2:15 says the law. We show the work of the law written in our hearts. The work of God's law. We're created in the image of God. Law flows from who God is. Because he is truth We must be truthful. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Ninth commandment of the Ten Commandments. The law written on human hearts. Remember, John Calvin and Martin Luther both believed that it was the Ten Commandments written in human hearts. We're going to see examples where Cicero gives that. Where you shouldn't steal, you shouldn't commit adultery, you shouldn't bear false witness, forge a will. Now remember, the Apostle Paul more than likely read Cicero. Cicero's writings were read by people in the first century AD, during the time of Christ and the Apostle Paul. Cicero's writings were read in the Roman Empire. But human beings are creatures who exist between the animals and God, sharing divine reason, law, and justice. We would agree with that. Jerusalem would agree with that. Third, a human being is a distinct species. We reject transgenderism. Cicero rejected transgenderism of the sophists. The sophist says anything goes. There's no order and structure to anything. You're just a changing, evolving thing. Could be anything. Now, when the law says, thou shalt not, or thou shalt, how can we have the rule of law and equality under the rule of law unless we are all equal as human beings? And this will come out within Cicero's to say, you cannot have the rule of law unless we agree that human beings are a distinct species. That one definition of man applies to us all equally. If you do not have that, you do not have equality under the law. Transgenderism destroys the rule of law. It's an argument of Cicero. The Bible would agree with that. Jerusalem would agree with that. Human beings are a distinct species, created in the image of God. God never changes. And therefore, we, in our being, our essence, you can never erase it, you can't change it. You're a human being. Male or female. Fourth, law and justice are based on the objective order of nature, not on man's opinion. Our opinions don't make reality. Isaiah 5:20, woe to those who call what is good evil and what is evil good. Your opinion does not make things right. Just in your mind, if you think that you're a woman, does not make you a woman. As Cicero would say, we're going to get into it, people are fools that think that they can vote whatever they want and make it then just because they voted it to be. No. What is justice is tied to the nature and order of reality. Objective reality established by the supreme divine being. Votes will not change it. Law and justice are based on the objective order of nature, not on man's opinion, not on a democratic vote. Jerusalem would agree with that. Stealing is stealing, and I don't care how many communists want to vote and say that they can collectivize all private property. Stealing is still stealing. Thou shalt not steal. Eighth commandment of the Ten Commandments. I don't care how many people vote that stealing's okay. Voting never makes it okay. That's what Cicero's arguing. Fifth, human moral excellence can only be realized in community. God created us male and female and said, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The church is the ecclesia in Greek, the called together ones. There are no lone rangers, really. We achieve moral excellence together. You may be moral alone, yes, you can, but excellence, I need support and encouragement from others. We need each other. And it's through community that moral excellence can only be achieved. And therefore, obviously, Cicero had a very positive, high view of the polis, the republic. My point is that these five things, these fundamental ideas of the worldview that he lays out, saying this is the worldview of the Roman Republic that made it last over 400 years, that gave character, high moral virtue to its citizenry, A successful republic depends upon a moral and religious people. And he's saying the core of that, that had been there for the Roman Republic that gave it success for over 400 years, was grounded in these five fundamental ideas. And you and I as Christians would agree with those five fundamental ideas. Jerusalem would agree with those five fundamental ideas. So we would say, why is Rome included, the Roman Republic that was pagan? Why is it included in Western civilization that we begin with Jerusalem? Because those five fundamental ideas we can agree with, it's just at the very end of who is God, who is that supreme being, is where he's worshiping an idol. Okay? Let me explain a little bit of that here. The first one. First, the world is an orderly cosmos or system governed by a rational divine providence. Cicero, in the Laws, wrote this, quote, "The authentic original law, whose function is to command and forbid, is the right reason of Jupiter, Lord of all." Unquote. I'll read it again. Quote, "The authentic original law," what he means by that is before there were any written laws, before civil society even formed, there was law. It existed. Why? Because God existed. In Christianity, we've got a good book, Principles of Conduct, Aspects of Biblical Ethics by John Murray. And in that book, John Murray lays out the creation ordinances, the creation laws that were there at creation. Even though yet you don't have any tablet of stone written out. There was no Mount Sinai yet. But yet law existed. And this is what he goes through as well in his writings. Speaking along that same ideas. Don't tell me there wasn't law before a human being or a civil society wrote down a law. Law still existed in this universe because the supreme being created it and put it there. Now, who is that supreme being? He says it's Jupiter. I'll read it again. Quote, "The authentic original law, whose function is to command and forbid, is the right reason of Jupiter, Lord of all." Unquote. Jupiter is the Roman name for the supreme god of the Greeks that they called Zeus, the chief god of all the Olympian gods and goddesses. So in their pantheon of Greek gods and goddesses, or Olympian gods and goddesses, the chief one was Zeus. And the Romans gave him the name Jupiter. So there's the idea of hierarchy of gods and goddesses within their paganism. And his view would be to say there are, in a sense, gradations, degrees of divinity. Remember, we've talked in our church history series on Origen, who died 253 AD. And he believed that Jesus Christ is the only begotten Son of God, eternally only begotten Son of God, but that he was a little less divine. That's what Origen believed. Because he embraced this pagan idea of Cicero and the other Greeks and Romans, that there's levels or degrees of divinity. Now the Nicene Creed rejected that in 325 AD. And said that the Son of God, Jesus Christ, is truly God. Equal with the Father, not inferior. What he had here, though, is this idea that there were many gods and goddesses. Some were more inferior, some were superior. But the chief was Jupiter, equivalent to Zeus in the Greek gods and goddesses. So he believed in a supreme divine being, Jupiter, Lord of all, that governs all. In other words, for him, all things came into existence by the supreme divine rational being for certain purposes, evidencing divine wisdom, benefiting man in many ways. In the Laws, Cicero states this. Some of these I've just given you a partial quote, okay? But in the Laws, Cicero states this. "Every growing thing seems to have been given to us on purpose. It does not come into existence by chance. And I don't mean just what shoots forth from the fertile earth, but also domestic animals. For they were obviously created for man's use or for his enjoyment or his food. Again, countless skills have been discovered thanks to nature's teaching. By copying her, reason has cleverly acquired the necessities of life. Unquote. He's saying everything has a purpose. By the supreme God has created all things for purposes. It's designed to benefit human beings, mankind. Either for man's use, his enjoyment, or his food. When you're looking at domestic animals or things that sprout from the ground, God is good and He created us last in the Christian worldview in the Bible in Genesis chapter 1. He doesn't have that view, but he has the view that all of these things were created for a purpose by the supreme God. In his mind, Jupiter. This is what's called, if you know your apologetics, evidentiary apologetics, the teleological argument for the existence of a supreme being. The teleological argument for the existence of a supreme being is that we observe purpose and design all around us. Things have purposes. R.C. Sproul wrote one of his books entitled Not a Chance. Very good book. I encourage you to read it if you ever get a chance. Chance only describes mathematical probability. And what R.C. Sproul said in his book, Not a Chance, is don't tell me this whole universe came about by chance. Chance does not cause anything. Chance is only describing mathematical probability. You have a coin, heads or tails. What's the chance of coming heads? 50%. Just mathematical probability. Flip it, right? Cicero wrote, every growing thing seems to have been given to us on purpose. It does not come into existence by chance. Don't tell me it came here by chance. Are you an idiot? Everything seems to be designed for man's benefit. Whether it's dogs, cats, beef from cattle, milk from the cow, you name it, eggs from the chicken, everything seems to be here for our purpose, either for our use, our enjoyment, our food. It's a teleological argument for the existence of a supreme being. Beautifully written by Cicero, a pagan. He says, again, countless skills have been discovered thanks to nature's teaching. By copying her, reason has cleverly acquired the necessities of life. Countless skills have been discovered thanks to nature's teaching. The idea here is, we brought it up into Jerusalem with Solomon, King Solomon. God gave him wisdom when he asked for wisdom. And you remember Solomon studied the animals and the trees. He was a scientist. He was studying the wisdom of God's works. Just two examples. We study things and we learn things of God's wisdom that's in His works. Two main ways water is purified. Two main ways water is purified. Reverse osmosis, and you boil it. Two main ways we purify water today. What we're doing is we're copying God's wisdom in nature. You boil it. What are we doing? You take water, you heat it up, you boil it, turn it from a liquid to a gas. Goes down a pipe to another end, you cool it. Pure water. All the impurities were left behind. You go out here in the parking lot in the middle of the summer and it rains and there's water with oil and gunk and dirt on the parking lot. But guess what? The sun comes out and the water evaporates. And what you have is pure water vapor, leaving behind all the gunk and terrible things. Pure water vapor, it rises, and then higher up in the atmosphere, it gets cooler, and it condenses on little dust particles, coalesces on them, and then eventually gets big enough to fall back as rain, fresh rain, pure rain, as a liquid that we can drink. How about microfiltration? This is where water is forced through many filters. When it rains, water hits the ground surface. If it exceeds the carrying capacity of that soil, it'll go off as surface runoff. But if it's within the infiltration rate, it begins to percolate through the soil. And that soil will act as a filter, so down eventually down in the groundwater, it'll be clean. And eventually then you can have a well that takes it back up and you can drink clean water. So what we've done is we've copied the wisdom of God in nature, in His works. And they were doing the same in their building projects with aqueducts and other things, thinking about how water flows and how houses are built and how structures work in the mathematical universe God created. Again, countless skills have been discovered thanks to nature's teaching. By copying her reason has cleverly acquired the necessities of life. In the Republic, Cicero states this: those who have studied the nature of reality as a whole have realized that this entire world is controlled by one mind. Unquote. Those who have studied the nature of reality as a whole have realized that this entire world is controlled by one mind. Unquote. Was he thinking of Pythagoras, who died in 500 BC? Or was he thinking of Heraclitus, who died 475 BC? Was he thinking of Anaxagoras, who died 428 BC? Whether the logos or the mind? In the Laws, Cicero states, as for the person who is not impelled to give thanks for the procession of the stars, the alternation of day and night, the regular succession of the seasons, and the fruits which are produced for our enjoyment, how can such a person be counted as human at all? Unquote. Romans 1:20 and 21. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that have been made, so that men are without excuse. So even though they knew God, they did not honor Him and give thanks. Cicero says, again, quote, as for the person who is not impelled to give thanks for the procession of the stars, the alternation of day and night, the regular succession of the seasons, and the fruits which are produced for our enjoyment, how can such a person be counted as human at all? Unquote. To be thankful to the supreme God who created all things. Remember, He didn't have the Old Testament scriptures. He didn't have the Bible. If all you had was studying general revelation, God's works of creation, you had the Greek philosophers, and here he is coming to these conclusions with an idol, Jupiter, the Lord of all. But so close. Really. He's saying we ought to be thankful to the divine, supreme, rational providence that is behind all of this order and goodness for you and I. We're one nation under God. Disagreement. We have that today. We have disagreement. Today with many religions in our society. The free exercise of religion allows it. I was talking with Hilda earlier this morning. I ran into and she says, yes, in America, we permit you to be wrong. And people will worship an idol, but there's many that are close. And we can agree, though, on the main worldview, the main structure. Rational human beings should understand that a supreme intelligent being governs all things in a mathematical, rational harmony, benefiting you and me as humans in many ways for which all of us should be thankful. That's essentially what he's saying. In the Republic, Cicero states this, quote, I just put part of it on the board. That remark of Plato's, or whoever made it, strikes me as very apt. When he had been driven by a storm at sea to an unknown land and cast up on a lonely shore, and the others were in terror because they knew nothing of the place, he is supposed to have noticed some geometric figures drawn in the sand. On seeing them, he cried, take heart, I see the traces of men. He drew this conclusion, evidently, not from the crops which he saw growing in the fields, but from signs of intellectual activity. unquote. In other words, as rational human beings, we ought to know evidence of intelligence when we see it. So when Watson and Crick discovered the double helix, the deoxyribonucleic acid of our genetic code, the double helix of DNA, and that there's a whole code there of information that codes for who you are and who I am, it's evidence of intelligence. Geometric figures drawn in the sand. What were they noticing when Thales accurately predicted a solar eclipse? Or Pythagoras with his Pythagorean theorem, or seeing the mathematical harmony of music? What were they understanding? What were they beginning to see? The geometric figures drawn in the world by the supreme intelligent being who designed and created it all. In fact, you have this today with, I think it's the Discovery Institute in the Pacific Northwest. They have their intelligent design movement. Dr. Michael Behe and others are involved in that. His wonderful book, Darwin's Black Box. But to say we have systems, and we have irreducibly complex systems that involve hundreds of different things at the biochemical level in the human body, and there's no way these systems could have evolved piece by piece. They had to all be there to perform a system function. Hundreds of different enzymes, active proteins involved just with blood clotting when you get cut so you don't bleed to death. So it's got to clot, and then it's got to stop the bleeding, right? And then it's got to shut down the clotting so it doesn't clot you to death, and then rebuild the skin, right? Well, that whole process at the biochemical level is evidence of intelligence, that some intelligent being designed it all. The system that's there. Well, you have that across the board, and he, at their level of science, is observing it at that time. The geometric figures drawn in the sands of this world. That there is evidence of intelligence, and you know it when you see it. A computer takes a computer coder. You have to have the code, some intelligence behind it, reason behind it, coding it, to perform a certain function in your software of your computer. Same with us, with our genetic codes. Intelligence. The rational mathematical world in which we live evidences that there is a supreme intelligent rational being who exists, who designed our universe and sustains it in a rational, harmonious fashion. That over this cosmos, this system, is a rational divine providence, a divine being who's behind it all and governing it all. Change is all about us, but always within a rational, orderly, mathematical system. In nature, there is both being and becoming. So the world is an orderly cosmos system governed by a rational divine providence. Secondly, human beings are creatures who exist between animals and God, sharing divine reason, law, and justice. In the Laws, Cicero states this: the creature of foresight, wisdom, variety, keenness, memory, endowed with reason and judgment, which we call man, was created by the supreme God to enjoy a remarkable status. Of all the types and species of living creatures, he is the only one that participates in reason and reflection, whereas none of the others do. What is there, I will not say in man, but in the whole of heaven and earth, more divine than reason, a faculty which, when it has developed and become complete, is rightly called wisdom? We're created in the image of God. What separates us primarily from the animals? You can read the book Jude. Read Jude, and it says, wicked sinners behave like unreasoning beasts. Animals, beasts are unreasoning. They don't have reason. When human beings are enslaved to sin, they act like an unreasoning animal. What separates us? What ought to separate us from the animals is human reason. And we think through all these things. You know, you say, I have a high calling in this world. God created me for a high purpose. To glorify Him. Be obedient to His laws. But he says, of all the types of species of living creatures, man is the only one that participates in reason and reflection where none of the others do. We're sitting here right now thinking and reasoning about law, justice, and the origin of the universe. My cat's at home. I have six cats. They're not sitting there thinking about that right now. Amy and Brent's dogs aren't sitting at home thinking about that right now. One dog. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. And neither is Tootsie, right, Sue?
Yeah.
No. Her dog, Tootsie. But notice how he said, the creature of foresight, wisdom, variety, keenness, memory, endowed with reason and judgment, which we call man, was created by the supreme God to enjoy a remarkable status. Animals do not have reason. Animals cannot understand the rational world around them. They're not going to be following the logical laws of non-contradiction or the law of causation. They're not rational. Now, I just say that because what do we have with Darwinian evolutionary theory? We're just a higher formed animal. That's always evolving and changing. And in that sense, there would be no such thing as human nature. A fixed essence of who we are that never changes. In the laws, Cicero continued, he wrote this, since then, there is nothing better than reason. Reason is present in both man and God. There is a primordial partnership in reason between man and God. But those who share reason also share right reason. And since that is law, we men must also be thought of as partners with the gods in law. Furthermore, those who share law share justice. There's a lot there in that one. But that idea of primordial partnership in reason. You and I, as Christians, would say God has reason. He's not irrational. He cannot deny himself. 2 Timothy 2:13. The law of non-contradiction flows from who he is. Christ and Antichrist cannot be the same thing. Good and evil cannot be the same thing. The world he created is governed by the law of non-contradiction. I've always said, you look at anybody who denies that and say, well, next time then just run the green light and the red light as if they're the same. Because that's what you're telling me. They're the same. No. Green is green and red is red. A cannot be non-A at the same time. We're in the same relationship. But God has reason, we have reason, and therefore we can communicate ideas together. But those who share reason share right reason, and his view is that is law. What is law? Right reason. Where you're thinking through things and say what ought to be. What's right. And therefore justice is derived from that. For those who share law then share justice. Now, interestingly, he interacts and he says the Greeks have the idea of law with justice, of each person getting their due. And we would say, like Luke 23:41, the believing thief on the cross, the murderous thief who believes in Jesus, who is now in paradise, but he was hanging on the cross next to Jesus and he talked to the unbelieving thief and he says, hey, we're getting what we justly deserve. But this man has done nothing wrong, Jesus. Justice is getting what you deserve. It is. That's, the law requires that. Right law requires that. But what's interesting is he referred to a Latin phrase for law, for choosing. So getting what you deserve, law and justice, but the idea as well is then right choosing. Because there's choices available. And it's a matter of saying what's right out of the various alternative choices. Legislators have that all the time, right? They're debating which should we choose to make law, right? He's thinking through that as a lawyer, right? So sharing right reason with God, since that is law, human beings have an awareness of ultimate accountability then to divine authority. In the Laws, Cicero states this: who would deny that these ideas of an intelligent divine authority over all things, who would deny that these ideas were useful, bearing in mind how many contracts are strengthened by the swearing of oaths, how valuable religious scruples are for guaranteeing treaties, how many people are restrained from crime by fear of divine retribution, and how sacred a thing a partnership of citizens is when the immortal gods are admitted to that company as judges and witnesses. Unquote. Now, again, he was a pagan, believed in multiple gods and goddesses, the supreme being Jupiter, Zeus. But he can understand to say, you know how critical it is when we swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? So help me God! He had a different idea of God, but to say, so help me God, and I know he's going to punish me if I break this oath. And they had the belief that I will be dealt with in this world by the gods if I break my oath. He knew how valuable theology was with order and structure in the cosmos. You get me? And we know that as Christians. The American founders said, nothing is secure of our private property or reputation if people lose their belief in God. Nothing is secure. People will lie in a heartbeat. In the Laws, Cicero states that man was, quote, endowed with the divine gift of mind, unquote, and that, quote, their mind was implanted in them by God, unquote. Say it again. In the Laws, Cicero states that man was, quote, endowed with the divine gift of mind, unquote, and that, quote, their mind was implanted in them by God, unquote. Significantly, in the Laws, Cicero then adds, quote, that is why, out of so many species, no creature apart from man has any conception of God, and why within mankind itself there is no tribe so civilized or so savage as not to know that it should believe in a God, even if it is mistaken about the kind of God it should believe in. Unquote. Read it again. That is why, out of so many species, no creature apart from man has any conception of God, and why within mankind itself there is no tribe so civilized or so savage as not to know that it should believe in a God, even if it is mistaken about the kind of God it should believe in. Unquote. Now, I did a series, you remember, on Wednesday night following Stephen Charnock, English Puritan from the 17th century. Existence and attributes of God as the primary source. If you remember from that series, what is this right here? Is the argument for the existence of a supreme being from universal consent. It's called the universal consent of mankind. That there is no group of people, no village, no tribe in the history of mankind that has not in one way or another been religious. It's an argument for the existence of a supreme being. This is what Cicero, the pagan, gives. What is he saying? We've learned from studying nature, the works of creation. What have we learned? The supreme being is intelligent and rational. Things are designed. They have purposes. Powerful to do all of this. Good. To be beneficial to all of us in many ways, for usefulness and food and other things. Wisdom. The way things are structured, and we can gain wisdom from it. All these things are gained by studying God's works of creation. This is Psalm 19, 1 through 4. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the expanse, the things of His hands. Day to day brings forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. It's Romans 1, 20. We learn things about God our Creator through His works of creation. All He had was that. He didn't have the Bible and the Old Testament scriptures. So in the end, he was an idolater, right? A false god. But the worldview of it all is very close to really understanding it all. Amazing. So human beings are creatures who exist between the animals and God, sharing divine reason, law, and justice. Now, as an aside, put a little bit at the end here, as an aside, we'll end this evening with this, and then next time we meet, we'll look at, in the worldview, the 5 points that are the basis for the worldview that gave the Roman Republic its success for over 400 years. This is his argument. We'll look at points 3, 4, and 5 next class. But as an aside, a central thesis of this class is that if one is mistaken about who God is, it will affect your ability to restrain your evil impulses. Say it again. If one is mistaken about who God is, it will affect your ability to restrain your evil impulses. It is one thing to know what you ought to do. It is quite another to be empowered by God Himself to obey His law. As the Bible describes Christ spiritually living in believers by the Holy Spirit, helping to put to death the sin that remains. Romans 8:13. Galatians 2:20. But I have been crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave Himself up for me. He lives in me by the Holy Spirit, helping me, empowering me to obey and serve Him. Cicero, as we shall see, we're going to be dealing with human conscience and other things. He believes in the human conscience, haunting guilty people, supreme God put within us. And he had the idea that adultery is wicked, stealing is wicked, lying is wicked. He showed the work of the law, God's law written in his heart. But he had an idol, Jupiter. It's one thing to know what you ought to do. It's a whole other thing to be empowered to do it. R.C. Sproul used to say, you know, you can look at a lot of marriage counseling books, and a lot of them have a lot of good things to say about what ought to be done. But the dilemma is there's nothing in them to help you, empower you to do it. And that's where we have the gospel. That's where we need the gospel of Jesus Christ to help empower us to do what's right. And one could say then that's one of the reasons why the Roman Republic fell eventually. But as we've already said regarding the fall of the Republic in Athens, their religion could not restrain their sinful desires. That is the assessment of Russell Kirk. Why, really, rock bottom at its core, why did the Republic of Athens fall? It's because of the weakness of their religion. It could not restrain their wicked, sinful desires. Republics depend upon self-controlled, self-governed people to exist and survive. So ultimately, what caused the republics of both Athens and Rome to fall was their idolatry, false notions about who God is. Fear of divine retribution alone is not enough to effectively restrain the power of sin within the human heart. It's there and it's good, but it alone won't do. We must remember that Cicero did not have the Bible, but was living solely under the knowledge he gained by studying general revelation, God's works of creation and providence. In my view, though, Cicero is the one pagan who came closest to the truth of reality, but still fell short in idolatry. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Romans 3:23. But he came the closest to understanding the truth that God revealed in his works of creation. I was utterly astounded and amazed to fully read the Republic in the Laws this last month. You say, how many societies out there? You think before Adoniram Judson went to Burma as the missionary bringing Christianity to Burma, but if all you had was the works of creation, what was around you in the jungle? could you have come up with all of this? The Greco-Roman world did. Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, and the pre-Socratics, and Cicero. Very close to the truth of reality. Unbelievable. Amazing. It's one of the reasons, not just the republics arose there in Athens and continued in Rome, in the Roman Republic, but also with this worldview, these 5 points that coincide with the biblical Christian worldview of reality, the way things really are. So Lord willing, we'll pick this up with point 3 in the worldview next time we meet next class.